Good evening, everyone. This week's Torah portion is a Torah portion of Mishpatim that deals almost exclusively, not totally, but almost exclusively with Jewish law. And in fact, it is the first Torah portion of the year that deals almost exclusively with Jewish law, because the entire book of Bereishis, of Genesis, 12, 13 weeks of Bereishis, and then you have the weeks leading up to Mishpatim and Shemos, deal with the stories of the creation, the stories of the Tower of Babel, the epic flood, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, the story of bondage in Exodus, and the story of the giving of Torah, which we had in last week's Torah portion. So therefore, this is really the first Torah portion of the year since Shabbos Bereishis, and all the way back there, that the Torah portion deals, again, not exclusively, because the end of the Torah portion does deal with giving us some of the background and backdrop material to the giving of Torah, but almost exclusively dealing with Jewish law, lots of Jewish law. And in fact, it begins chapter 21, verse number 1, where Zer Mishpatim begins. And in the book that we're using, which is the Saperstein Chumash Rashi of Yatsko, it's on page 248. And the verse begins, Ve'ela Mishpatim, these are the judgments Asher Tasim Lefneihem, that you will place before them. It is known that Torah law are many times divided between three different types of laws. There are Eidos, which are testimony, the things that happened in the past. We observe the Shabbat because God created the world in 6 days and he rested on Shabbat. We will be observing the holiday of Pesach because the Jews left Egypt and they took the unbaked dough with them, and they break it as matzah, so therefore we eat matzah during the holiday of Pesach. We have the laws in the category of chukim, which are really transcendent in terms of why we keep kosher. There's no obvious reason why. There is a divine reason, but those reasons are transcendent from us. Those are the chukim. And then we have mishpatim, and mishpatim are translated as judgments, and for the most part we associate mishpatim with laws that make sense, much more logical. And before I get into that issue of whether Mishpatim really all make sense or not, Rashi first tells us in verse number 1, Asher Tasim Lefneihem. So Rashi says, V'lo Lefnei Goyim, Afili Adaita B'Nechad Shem Don Hoso Kidin Yisrael Al to the Yehu Barkoy Shalem. Rashi talks about the importance of going to a Jewish court, not to a secular court, not to a Gentile court. So Hashem, Rashi tells us, Chal Hashem is called the desecration in the name of God. Now, in terms though of secular law, there is a principle of Dina Machusa Dina, which means the law of the land becomes law in terms of halacha. And one can say that I just don't appreciate the law of the land, and therefore I'm not going to pay my taxes. As long as what we call Obamacare is the law of the land, it's the law of the land. And we have an obligation of observing it and following it because of this principle called Dina de Malchusa Dina, following the law of the land. On the other hand, when the law of the land is in contradiction to Torah law, then according to most poskim, most authorities, we have an obligation of following the Torah law. To give you an example, we have in America bankruptcy laws. A person owes money to someone else, business owes money to someone else, and according to American bankruptcy law, a judge can determine, kapaskin, that a part of the debt or the entire debt is null and void. Person can't pay it. Person's bankrupt. Now that is something which is acceptable in secular law. But in terms of Jewish law, if you owe someone money and you can't pay it, well, you don't pay it now, you might have to pay next year, but is able to pay back 10 years from now, or 15 years from now, or 20 years from now, there is no statute of limitation when it comes to debt in Jewish law. So even though we do accept the law of the land, but when the law of the land is vestita, when it's in contradiction to Torah law, so according to most of the poskim, we have an obligation of following the Torah law, and therefore, in that particular example I gave you, the debt remains a debt, and is sometime in the future able to pay it back, you have an obligation of paying it back. So, this is true not with just with debt law, with all issues of American law that might be in contradiction to Torah law, we as Torah Jews have an obligation of following Torah law, and therefore going to Jewish courts, working out our differences in Jewish courts, because many times a Jewish court will see things very differently than a secular court. Now, getting back to the issue of mishpatim, and as I explained to you, a mishpat usually is considered something which makes sense. But truth to be told, if we look at the body of Torah law, I'm just taking a couple, several examples in this week's Torah portion, it becomes obvious that a mishpat is something which in terms of the general outline makes sense. But when you get to the details of it, it becomes apparent to us that the wisdom of Torah law is a wisdom which is transcendent, it's part of God's wisdom, and if we get to the details, the nitty-gritty of Torah law, it's apparent that we just can't relate to many ideas. To give some examples, this week's Torah portion talks about what is called bar. And that is, if a person creates a dangerous situation, bar literally means a person creates and digs a hole in the street, in the public area, dig a hole. And there the Torah says, V'nafal shama shar archamar, that an ox will fall into it, or a donkey will fall into it. So there it says, you are, the person who made this hole, made this dangerous situation, has to pay for damages. But the Gemara tells us, shar v'li adam, that only if a animal walks into the ditch, do you have to pay for the animal. But if a human falls into the ditch, you don't have to, because the woman, this human being should have watched himself or herself when she was walking. That makes sense. But then the Gemara tells us, Chamar v'lakelim, as Rashi tells us. Chamar v'lakelim, that means only if a donkey walks in, and that's according to the old tradition, that comes to exclude that if a donkey is carrying some breakable glasses or any other type of item which is breakable, and the donkey falls in, and the glasses fall in with the donkey, obviously, and both are injured and destroyed, you pay for the donkey, but not for the glasses, not for the objects. There's no obvious reason for that. Another example, Torah talks about another form of damage that you have to pay for, this week's Torah portion. If a person starts a fire, and the fire spreads from your property to someone else's property, then you must pay for damages, which should be quite obvious. But the Gemara tells us, based on a pasuk, which is a kama, talking about open stalks, the Torah talks about, in this week's third portion, when fire spreads to open stalks, Talmud tells us, your tradition teaches us, that the halacha is this only applies to stalks which are revealed, exposed, but if someone starts a fire and spreads to someone's house, and in the house, there are things that are hidden in the house, then the person who started the fire is exempt from payment for those things which are hidden. Eish v'leit tomen. Kama v'leit tomen. Something which is hidden, one is not obligated to pay for. So again, we're talking about, so therefore the general outline of the obligation to pay for starting a fire is something which you can relate to. You get to some of the details, it becomes apparent to us that for reasons which we can't logically understand, the halachi is that if the fire goes and destroys something which is hidden, then you don't have to pay for that. Why? Who knows why? So there are many examples of this in all the Torah reports, especially in Mishpatim. So therefore, it's important to realize that although many times people make this statement that Mishpatim includes laws that are logical, everything is relative. Logical, relative maybe to some laws of kashrus, which are laws which are chukim, So Mishpatim might be considered to be logical. But in Mishpatim itself, in dealing with Mishpatim itself, it becomes apparent that we're dealing with a wisdom which is God's transcendent wisdom, and therefore many of these laws don't make sense to the average human being. Now, the Torah begins in verse number 2. Of all the Mishpatim, of all the laws that it begins with, it deals with something which is a little difficult for us to relate to, why it would begin with an issue of Eved, Ivri. But in verse number 2, the Torah tells us when you buy a Eved, Ivri, who is a Jewish servant, the servant shall work for 6 years, and the seventh he shall go to freedom without charge. So as Rashi comments, we're talking about why would someone become a servant? Well, two reasons why a person might become a servant. One is not mentioned in this week's Torah portion. One is when a person might be so poor, and in biblical times they didn't have the same safety net that we have today. People had to give tzedakah, but it was not something which was from the government. The government had a whole safety net to make sure people had food and clothing and domicile. So there could be a situation where people were concerned about their safety and about their good, about their health. So people at times could sell themselves into servitude. It's an option which was, should be a last option, but it did happen. But that's not something of this historic portion. This historic portion talks about someone who was sold, and as Rashi says, we're talking someone who was a ganav, someone who was a thief. And the halakha is, the law is, that when a person steals, if they are caught and they are guilty, they must then make a double payment. So a person steals $1,000 worth of goods, and they're caught and they're found to be guilty, then they have to pay $2,000 to the victim of the crime. And therefore, Rashi explains, talking about someone who doesn't have the money, the ganef, the thief doesn't have $2,000, and he is sold on the open market as a servant, and the money that is accrued from the sale would go to the victim of the crime. Now, it's important to realize that in Judaism, the concept of prison does not exist. We have in this historic portion the idea of a jail. That is when a person is temporarily put in a holding pattern, in a jail. This historic portion talks about someone who hits someone, and we're concerned that the person who was victimized might die, and therefore if he does die, we want to make sure that we're holding on to the assailant, because we might have to put him to death. So in the meantime, we put the assailant in a jail, hold him there temporarily. But in terms of punishment, prison time as punishment, we don't find that. In Judaism, we have corporal punishment, at times there's capital punishment, there's monetary punishment. Those are the punishments that the Torah talks about. Now at the same time, the Rambam, in fact, tonight is an important day to discuss the Rambam, Maimonides, 12th century. Rambam, as you know, was the first person to write an encyclopedia of the entire Torah. He has, it's called Yad HaChazaka, 83 different books that he has, and he goes from every aspect within Torah law. Even those things that are not relevant today were written up by the Rambam. As opposed to the Shulchan Aruch, which was written in the 16th century, that deals for the most part with laws that are relevant in that time and relevant to us today. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch written by Rabbi Yosef Kaira, Moshe Islis, we talked about him a couple of weeks ago, only has a limited amount of Torah law. It's a great amount, but it's still limited. As opposed to Rambam, that deals with, he deals with everything. And in terms of Rambam writes, he cites different sources. He doesn't cite the sources, but his information is from different sources. That even though in Judaism the idea of punishment in jail, in a prison, doesn't exist, but the justices of every society, talking about Torah justices, Jewish justices, have an obligation of keeping the peace. And therefore, they have the right to do whatever they have to do to keep the peace. If they determine a certain person is dangerous and therefore should not be functioning in society, they'll take him off the street and put him in prison. But not as a punishment. But rather to make sure that this person, that the society is safe. And therefore, Torah apparently looks at being in prison as a waste of time, something which will really not help the person. But as I said, according to Rambam, of course, can do it just to save society, but not as punishment. And in this situation, Torah tells us, if a person doesn't have the ability to pay back the victim of his crime, he stole money. So the person is sold on the servant market, called the slave market. We don't like the term slave, but he's called an eved, which is servant. And as I said, the money that is accrued from the sale goes to the victim of the crime. When this person is sold, by the way, as the word tells us, when you buy a Jewish servant, because the person is a thief, and apparently you feel you can handle him, you feel that hopefully you might be able to some way rehabilitate this thief. But if this thief is married and has a child or two or more, you have an obligation of making sure that those children that he has won't starve to death. His wife and children won't starve to death. So there's a great responsibility in doing what you're doing. And we've got to assume that the person you're buying as a servant is very useful to you, and he must have some great skills, and that's why you're doing it. So the Torah tells us that this person will serve as a servant for 6 years, and the maximum of 6 years, and the seventh year, he gets his freedom. And then the Torah tells us, among the things that you're able to do with him, and I must admit that I'm about to say, this part of the mitzvah, the concept that is as far as I'm concerned, the most difficult part of Torah for me to understand is this part over here. I've never found in Torah itself something as called bizarre. But the Torah tells us this ganif, this Jewish man who was a thief, who was a married man, got to be a married man. So the law is that his Jewish master has a right to give him a non-Jewish servant, woman, to sire children with her, and those children would then belong to the master. That's what Torah tells us. Now, this notion that the Torah condones this, allows this to happen, that a Jewish master will take a Jewish married man, and for this period of time allow to give him a Gentile servant, who we're talking about someone not totally Gentile. There is in Halacha today, there's either Jew or Gentile. But in times of Torah, there was a third category of an Eved, a servant. A servant had to accept the negative mitzvahs. Judaism couldn't violate the Shabbos, couldn't eat treif, had to go to mikveh, but was not Jewish yet. So some sort of in between status in Jew and non-Jew. And here the Torah tells us that the master has a right, and has a right to do this, has a right to take this Jewish ganif, and for those 6 years have him sire children with a shifcha, knanis, with a non-Jewish servant. Pretty strange. So there's nothing, as far as I'm concerned, nothing more unusual, and I really have no way to understand that, to explain that. But be it as it may, after 6 years, he decides he doesn't want to leave because he's attached to his new wife. He has another wife, a Jewish wife at home. And anyway, so he doesn't want to leave. So the Torah tells us, this person, we take him to the doorpost, and we take an awl, which is an instrument, and we drill his ear, and we put a big hole in his ear, which is a very unusual thing that we're doing. This is the only sin in Judaism. We look askance at this. God is against this. Why would you want to continue your... we can understand why you might want to do it, but it's totally inappropriate for you to now... You have an opportunity to leave servitude, and you're willing to give that up. And the Torah tells us that if you're willing to have your ear drilled with a big hole... There are different areas in Judaism where God says, you know, I'm against it. But if you insist, I'm not going to block it. This is an example of that. And as Rashi comments, that even when a person is very poor, a person should never sell oneself as a servant. And even though, as I said, today, in those days, they didn't have the social net that we have today. But selling oneself is something which one should really never do, because God says, Avodai Haim, I took you out of Egypt to be free people, to use your time the way you want to use your time. When you become a servant, your time is not yours. When you become a servant, basically, your master has no right to abuse you. And that's why there are many Gentiles who want to become Jewish servants. And they're willing to undergo circumcision. Because to become a Jewish servant, you have to undergo circumcision, you have to accept the Shabbos, you have to accept not eating treif. But there are many Gentiles trying to do that because they felt that there was security in Jewish masters, and Jewish masters were nice to their servants. Jews always had the sense of rachmanis, of mercy for people, sensitivity for people, empathy for people. So there's reasons why people did that. But the downside to being a servant, even with a master who is a Jewish master, was that your time was not your time. Your master had the right to ask you to do whatever he wanted you to do, as long as it wasn't abusive. And God says, I want you to use your time according to what you should be doing, what you want to do, and your time should not be in someone else's hands. In fact, the Rebbe asked the question, there is no other mitzvah in Judaism, another practice where we find a person who misbehaves or something inappropriate that we publicly are going to shame him by drilling a big hole in the person's ear. Only here. So Rashi says that the reason we do this is that every one of us, we believe every Jew is at Mount Sinai. We talked about it last week. Every Jew is at Mount Sinai, even those who were not living then. I told you the story of Amelva Zensk, the great tzaddik of the 18th century, who said, not only does he remember being at Mount Sinai, he can tell you the names of all the souls around him. So all of us are at Mount Sinai. So Rashi brings down the statement from Chazal, from our masters, from our teachers, that you are there at Mount Sinai. You heard God say, don't steal. And you went ahead and stole, so therefore we're going to take your ear and drill your ear. Or you heard where God said, Avodayhem, you are my servants. You went ahead and you bought a master for yourself instead of being a servant only to God. And if we're going to take this drill and drill your ear. So the Rebbe explains, why is it that we do a dafka only in this situation? Well, there are more severe sins than this, worse sins than this. And the Rebbe said, in a certain way, this is a very severe sort of a sin. When a person goes and steals, sometimes people do it out of desperation. Sometimes people are professional ganavim, professional thieves. But many people can do it out of desperation. So if a person steals and gets into a problem, he doesn't have money to pay back the double amount that he has to pay, and he's sold as a slave. That's one thing. But if there are 6 years to be a slave and not to be disturbed by the fact that everyone's able to point to you, say, this person was a ganav. And this person, because they lost his freedom. And if for 6 years you still want to go ahead and remain a servant and serve other people, such a person is deserving of having that ear drilled. One of the ideas I once mentioned years ago was, again, the question was, that Rashi brings down that this person went ahead and stole, so because he stole, therefore, he heard him outside, and not to steal, he shouldn't steal, and he stole, so therefore, drill is here. What about the first time when he stole? Why did he wait 6 years? And perhaps another answer is that we're not just talking about stealing from the other person. That person he stole from, the person might have been desperate, so he stole from another person. But when a person is a servant, and after 6 years you still want to remain a servant, what you're doing is you're stealing the time from your divine soul. Your divine soul has a mission in life. To make the world a better place, to bring divinity into the world, to bring the light of Torah into the world. And when you agree to remain a servant for who knows how much longer, up until the Jubilee year, that's called stealing from the divine soul, stealing time from the divine soul. There's nothing more precious than time. And for you to give up your time and give your life in the hands of someone who is a master who will direct you what you can do with your time and not do what you should be doing with your time, that's the ultimate ganav. That's the ultimate thief. The Alter Rebbe in Lakuta in the Torah R, we know that every verse in Judaism has what's called a level of pshat, basic understanding, interpretation of the verse. And on top of that, there is levels of Jewish homiletics and all different types of layers of homiletics. So the Rebbe tells us on a level of pshat, again, the question is, why does the Torah begin the Elam Mishpatim? They said, this is the first Torah portion that deals almost exclusively with Jewish law. Deals with Mishpatim, tort law. Laws which we said, for the most part, seem to make some sense to us. Why did the Torah pick this as the first law, the idea of a person goes, it's not common for people to go steal, become an heir, become a servant, and serve 6 years, why begin with this? You have every right in Torah, Shneur Zalman writes in Torah, that the idea of being an Eved Ivri, a Jewish servant, and serving for, what does the verse say? The verse says in verse number 2, for 6 years you shall work, uvashviyas, yetzei lachav shechinim, and on the 7th year he shall go to freedom without charge. So the Alter Rebbe says the 6 years refers to the 6th millennia. We know that in creation, we have 6 days of creation, and the 7th day is the day of rest, Shabbos. So the Ramban, the beginning of the Chumash, talks about this, and is discussed by many other commentaries, that the 6 years represent, the Gemara talks about it in fact, that the 6 years represent the 6,000 years where we serve God. According to the Jewish calendar, we are now in the 5,773. How to reconcile this with how other geologists talk about the date of the earth, age of the earth, I'm not going to get into this right now, but as far as we're concerned, it's 5,763. The tradition that we have in the Torah, in the Talmud, is that we talk about a 6,000 year period where we have the mitzvahs that we do, and then we have the Messianic era. When it says the 6 years we work, it means we try to elevate the world, fix the world, correct the world. We're called tikkun olam, right? Correcting the world from its fault during the 6th millennia. And on the 7th millennia, it says, Yetzei lachofshi chinam. We go to freedom, chinam. So, Alter Rebbe cites the Maamar Chazal, the statement, what does it mean? We go lachofshi, free, free from its fault. And Alter Rebbe writes that even though there are different opinions, whether we will have a mitzvah or Mashiach will come. So, in fact, there's a number of different talks from the Rebbe about this. Now, the Rebbe writes in Tanya, that certainly the initial, so when Mashiach will come initially, we're waiting for him to come, hopefully he'll come tonight, tomorrow. When he will come, there's certainly no question we'll be observing mitzvah. That's a basic belief that we intended in Judaism. And again, as I said, the Rambam, and tonight we celebrate the completion of the cycle of the Rambam, studying the Rambam for the year. The Rambam talks about the coming of Mashiach. He talks about the halacha of the coming of Mashiach, as opposed to Shulchan Aruch, which doesn't deal with that. And the Rambam tells us very clearly, we certainly will have mitzvah, Mashiach will come. What the Rambam doesn't discuss, and the Rebbe does discuss, the Rebbe discusses it also, there are opinions that when the dead will come back to life, which is another belief that we have, that sometime after that, according to some opinions, we will not have mitzvot. Mitzvot will only be for initially during this period of Messianic era, but at some period later, if the dead come back to life, there will be a time when we won't have mitzvot. And then the other guy also says in the 6th Torah portion in Torah that even according to opinions, there will always be mitzvot. But mitzvot certainly will be very different. No question about it. Not the same sort of mitzvot. Kavanos will be different. Many things will be different. Whichever way, there's another issue, again, talking about the Rambam, and something which is hard to understand, puzzling is the word. When the Rambam ends, and today people ended the study of the Rambam, many people did. This is something that Rebbe asked that different track system. Yes, those who can study and finish the entire works of the Rambam, all 83 books every year should do it. Others do it every 3 years, because some people do 3 chapters a day of Rambam, and if you follow a whole year, you'll finish the entire work of the Rambam once a year. Others do it once in 3 years. The Rambam ends he talks about the coming of Mashiach. He does not talk about the dead coming back to life. If you look earlier in the Yad HaChazaka of the Rambam, when he talks about the ultimate idea of the world to come, he talks about a world without bodies, just spiritual entities, spiritual souls relating to God. So the Rambam seems to be suggesting that the ultimate reward that the soul will have will be when the soul is bereft of the physical body, stripped of the physical body. That's Rambam's opinion. The Rambam, as I said, in the Yad HaChazaka, in this famous work, doesn't really talk about the dead coming back to life. At the same time, the Rambam wrote a preamble, prologue to Masechta Sanhedrin, to the last chapter, Pcholak, in the Tractate Sanhedrin, and there, the Rambam establishes 13 principles of faith for Jews. And the last one is the belief that the dead will come back to life. They're called the Animamins. In fact, when the Rambam initially created the Animamins, there were many of his contemporaries who took umbrage at this, were upset, and they wondered where the Rambam got what they felt the temerity to take the Torah and break it down to 13 principles. We don't have in the Gemara any mention of 13 principles. The Rambam felt that he distilled from the Gemara what he felt were the most important principles of Judaism. And there, the Rambam does talk about the dead coming back to life, the 13th principle, the final principle. So again, it's what's puzzling is that the Rambam in the Yad HaChazaka, which is his most famous work, encyclopedic work, which, again, as I said, many people ended it today, the Rambam talks about the coming of Mashiach. Earlier, much earlier, the Rambam talks about the idea of the ultimate reward will be the reward of the souls relating to God. Doesn't talk about souls and bodies. But he does talk about, as I said, in his Pirsut Mishnayos, interpretation, commentary to Mishnayos, in Masechtas Sanhedrin, Berachot, there he does talk about, and that's where he creates the 13 principles, including the last principle, of the dead coming back to life. But even though the Rambam seems to be suggesting that the ultimate reward is when the soul will be stripped of a body, the soul and God, souls and God, this is not embraced by most of the great, especially Kabbalists, including the Rambam also. Most of the teachers of Kabbalah disagree with Rambam and believe that the ultimate reward will be when the souls come back to physical bodies and engage God, because these souls serve God with physical bodies and with physical things in life. So the opinion of many of the Rishonim, and especially almost all of the Kabbalah, including the Arizal, is not like the Rambam, but rather where the Rambam believes that the ultimate reward will be the soul and God, soul stripped of a physical body. This is not the accepted opinion of the Mekubalim and many of the Rishonim. But whichever way, the Abba Rebbe tells us that when it says in verse number 2, that here it says 6 years the servant will work, and on the 7th year he will gain his freedom. So as I said, on a level of homiletics, the verse is talking about not just that, but also that 6 millennia we will serve God with the mitzvos. We know Mashiach is supposed to come before the end of the 6 millennia. We don't have to wait for the year 6000. It has to come earlier than that. And that's why we're waiting for Mashiach, and the hope that it will come every day, any day. And that we talked about the imminence of the coming of Mashiach. But whichever way, the Torah is telling us, in the 7th millennium, after Mashiach comes, and hopefully if they're, according to the Arizal, Mashiach will come, and 40 years later we will have the dead coming back to life. And we'll still have mitzvahs then. Some point after then, according to some opinions, we won't have mitzvahs anymore. Sometime after that, it will just be a relationship where we are enjoying the rays of God's Shekhinah. But as the Rebbe writes in Torah today, this is the third portion, that even according to opinions, that we will always have mitzvahs. The mitzvah will certainly be different. First of all, we won't have the Yetzirah, we won't have the animal instinct that tries to discourage us from doing mitzvahs with enthusiasm. So obviously mitzvahs are going to be very, very different. But that's how the Alter Rebbe, therefore, explains verse number 2. The Torah talks about, in verse number 7, something which, again, hard to relate to. But as I said, the reason we can relate to this is the idea of selling, Torah talks about selling your daughter into servitude. And again, we can't relate to this because today we have a social net which covers everybody, no one starves to death. But in Judaism then, they didn't have the same social net. There wasn't the wealth we have today. So the Torah talks about a man selling his daughter into servitude. But when you sold your daughter, you can only sell her up to her 12th birthday. Once she became 12 years old, she became free. A 12-year-old young lady is independent, which raises the question, why would someone want to buy someone who's 10 years old? And the answer is that, let's remember, in those days, the life expectancy was much less. People lived, 40, 50 years, many people then. And therefore, people matured much earlier. Grew up much earlier. And therefore, apparently, girls who were 9, 10 years old, apparently were quite valuable. The Torah is telling us there is a mitzvah, in order, when a person sells their daughter into servitude, you can imagine the type of shame it brings on the entire family, certainly on this young lady. So there is a mitzvah for the master or the master's son. It's called the mitzvah of Yehud, to marry her. And this way, remove the stigma of being a servant. That's a mitzvah. And in fact, the money, it's called yield, the money that the master gave to buy her can be now considered the money which would be the wedding money. Because when a person marries a woman, he has to give her something of value. Say, we give rings. It doesn't have to be a ring, but we give a ring. That's called Kesef Kedushin. So this mitzvah is that the money that was given to the father of this young lady can serve as what we call the kedusha money, the marriage money. And then what's interesting is that sometimes the Torah tells us certain laws, which are important laws, in a very backdoor way, instead of going through the front door in a backdoor way. Because the other Torah tells us, If the son marries her, and we're in verse number 9 and 10, Torah says, you've done this for the mitzvah. So we know that as of 1,000 years ago, you can't marry more than one woman, especially in Ashkenaz circles. But you've done this for the mitzvah, and therefore you really like to marry someone else also. So the Torah tells us in verse number 10, in our Chumash, page 256, that if you decide that you've done a mitzvah, you've done the mitzvah of Yehud, and therefore you want to marry her, but you really want to marry someone else also, which you can do, in the old days you had the right to do such a thing. So in verse number 10, the Torah talks about something which deals with all marriages, which the Torah really never discussed before, and will not discuss later, but just in this backhanded way, it will tell you that even if you go and marry a second wife, because you really don't care for this wife that much, you just did it for the mitzvah. But the three basic obligations that a husband has for a wife must be kept with the first wife, despite the fact that you have now a second wife also. And what are the three basic obligations? Sheretz v'enasa. And they are food, clothing. Clothing means matches clothing, but domicile. And her time, which means conjugal rights. And these are, in halacha today, three basic obligations that a husband has towards his wife. And if in any of these three the husband can't provide, that technically would be, halachically, grounds for divorce. So, she doesn't have to demand a divorce, but if a husband can't support his wife, can't provide food for her, clothing for her, domicile for her, well, if the husband becomes impotent and can't provide conjugal rights for her, if she wants, she can go to a Beis Din and demand a divorce for any of these three things. And in fact, halachically, there can be prenuptials where a woman can say to her husband, because according to basic law, husband has to support his wife, and she has to hand over her paycheck to her husband, according to technically. But before the marriage, they make a prenuptial. where she said to her husband, listen, whatever I make is mine. I'm not sharing with you. And you don't have to support me. That's fine. So when it comes, especially when it comes to monetary issues, prenuptials are valid, and you must live without those prenuptials. When it comes to non-monetary issues, the issue of principle, when it comes to conjugal rights, obligations, let us say a woman gets married, and before she gets married, she tells her husband that I'm not expecting any intimacy, I'm expecting from you some very limited intimacy, and don't worry about it. But then she gets married and she realizes that she needs more, she wants more. The halacha is she can always change her mind. Because according to halacha, when it comes to monetary issues, she can say, I thought I can do this, but I see I really can't handle it. When it comes, it's interesting, when it comes to these issues of, I'm not going to get into the issue of conjugal issues, but the truth of the matter is that let's say a man lives at home. And he has, his job is at home. And then he decides that he'd like to pursue a livelihood which involves his leaving town for long periods of time. Well, he can't do without his right, without his wife's permission because she has conjugal rights. The only time a man can leave his wife without a permission, according to halacha, would be if he goes to study Torah. And there were cases where men would go away for a year, 2 years. Rabbi Akiva left his wife for 24 years. That's the only exception that a husband would have a right to decide to leave. He has to support her. He can't just go and study Torah without supporting her. So he must make sure that she's taken care of. But he decides to go and to go to yeshiva for a couple of years, and he makes sure that his kids and his wife are supported, that halacha would be okay. It's not necessarily the best idea to do that, but in terms of halacha, that's considered to be okay. There are, in terms of, well, that should suffice now for this issue. The Torah talks about issues of someone attacking someone else, and damages that you have to pay for injuring someone, including issues of sick leave, doctor bills. In fact, on verse number 19, chapter number 21, talks about the obligation to pay for sick leave and also verapa yirape, to pay for, to heal the person. In fact, the Gemara tells us from verse number 19 is how we know that we believe in going to doctors. One might have thought that if God strikes you with some disease, maybe your obligation is just to pray to God and not go to doctors. If God is the one who hurts you with this disease, visited upon you, maybe you just pray to God. So how do you know you have a right to go to doctors, an obligation to go to doctors? It's verse number 19, Verapa Yirape. Although the Ramban tells us, Nachmanides tells us, the great tzaddikim, great nevi'im during those biblical days, God dealt with them in a very different way, and they very rarely did go to doctors. They prayed to God, and they had a different relationship with God. But for us, people like ourselves, to skip doctors and just put our trust in God, we have a principle, ein somchan al nes. So a person has a disease, and for you to hope they'll be, without going to doctors, just rely on a miracle. Miracles happen, but we have an obligation of not relying on miracles in some colonies. The third portion is packed with many different ideas. Let's see what we're going to study tonight. Right, let me, yes.
You say you have to support the wife. Does it say what kind of level of luxury, or does basically she's got food, she's got food?
If you can afford it, if your wife, when she got married, was used to a certain level of luxury, and you can afford it, then your obligation is to maintain that level that she was used before she got married. That's the halacha. Now, if you yourself and your sisters and your mother was used to a certain level of luxury, and then you're marrying someone who is not, so the Gemara tells us, Ola imo, that she goes up with you and doesn't descend with you. So therefore, if your mother was treated by your father certain way and your sisters, then you have an obligation, if you can afford it, to treat your wife the same manner. All right, so in verse number 6, that's in chapter 22, verse number 6, in our Chumash, page 280, the Torah talks about the first of four different shomrim. Now, a shomer is someone who takes something of yours, you give a person something, and there's the four levels of shomer. This is very basic in halacha. And if you look in Tractate Bava Metzia, it's discussed at length. There is the shomer chinam, the unpaid watchman. There is the paid watchman. There is the borrower. And then there is the renter. And the four categories of obligations that you have, liability. The one who has the least liability is the unpaid watchman. That person is doing you a favor, they're going out of town, and you give your dog to your friend, and you tell that friend to watch the dog for you. As long as that person has not been negligent, the person has watched it correctly, and the animal is stolen or lost, you watched it correctly, as long as you're willing to take an oath, come back, the person comes back and says, where's my dog? And you say, well, let me tell you, it was stolen by someone. It was a ganeft, it was a thief in the neighborhood. So if he doesn't believe you and you're willing to take an oath that you watched it correctly, then you can take the oath and you have to pay nothing. If you're a paid watchman, you have to pay, because after all, that's why he paid you, to take care of it well, to use better a better approach of security. Make sure things were watched in a better way. The other extreme would be the borrower. If someone borrows an item and an accident happens, let's say you borrow someone's car and you park it on the street, park it properly, and you come back sometime later and you see that someone smashed into the door and you don't know who it was. You can't locate the person who was the guilty party. So there might be insurance, but there's a deductible. Many times the rates go up because of this. And even though you tell the person who lent it to you that it wasn't your fault because you took care of it correctly and properly, but you have to pay the deductible. And the insurance rates go up, usually for 3 years they go up, you have to make that, pay that differential. So that's the other extreme. That's the borrower. If you're a renter, it's something else, because the renter is paying, because he's paying for this, therefore if an accident happens, he doesn't have to pay. But the borrower is not paying. So the borrower is kula hano shalo, everything is, he's accruing benefits by himself totally, and therefore the borrower is, he's one on the other extreme. So what I want to do with just tonight is just discuss in verse number 6 and 7, and what is it, and 8, the basic pirush, basic interpretation, and then show you what Chassidus says. And that is verse number 6 talks about, even though the Torah does not identify clearly, that we're talking about an unpaid watchman, but the old tradition identifies this, that verse number 6, 7, and 8 is talking about an unpaid watchman. It's called a shomer chinam. This is the way of Torah, by the way. Many times Torah deliberately tries to be a bit vague and wants us to use our cup, wants us to use our minds in understanding what it's really referring to. So, again, verse 6 does not clearly state it's talking about an unpaid watchman, but it is, according to the oral tradition. It says a person will give to his friend money or vessels to his fellow to safeguard, and it is stolen from the house of the man. If the thief will be found, he shall pay too. The thief pays a double amount. Let's learn that at this point, he pays two to the original owner. But if the thief will not be found, then the householder, and the householder here means the shomer, the watchman. So he's the watchman, and the owner comes, what happened to my dog, whatever it is, the laptop. And he says it was stolen, and I was not in any way responsible for the theft. I was not irresponsible. And the owner doesn't trust this watchman. So the householder, who is the who means the shomer here, the watchman, shall approach the judges with a claim that he had not laid his hand upon his fellow's property. Meaning, that's another halacha. That if the owner gives you something to watch, let's say he gives you a laptop to watch, and or a car, just take care of the car, watch the car. Don't use the car, just watch the car. And the watchman goes and uses the car, takes it for a drive for himself, which he shouldn't have done. So even though you're saying he's not a thief, but that's called being a thief. And the law is, once you're a thief, then even though the watchman, let's say, used the car and puts it back and parks it properly, and then an accident happens to the car, totally unrelated to the use of the car by this watchman. But because he used it inappropriately, he becomes a gun, he becomes a thief. And as a thief, later, if an accident happens to this car, this watchman is responsible. Therefore, it says over here that this guy goes, he approaches the judges with a claim that he had not laid his hand upon his fellow's property. He says, I never used it for personal purposes. And then it says, in verse number 8, for any sinful word. If we find out, there are witnesses who will come and say that what he is saying is not true. He's lying. He used it. Whether it's an ox, for a donkey, or for a sheep, or for a garment. For any lost item about which he will say, according to Rashi, what it means, for any lost item which a witness will come and say that this man is lying. The oath you took, you were lying. Perjure yourself. So then the judges shall come both, to the judge shall come both their claims. It means the claim of the watchman who says that the oath that he took was a valid oath, and the claim of the witness that wasn't valid, so the judges will deal with the issue. Whoever the court finds guilty shall pay two to his fellow. Which means we find out that it was really the watchman who took the car for himself and stole the car, so he becomes the ganif, and therefore he has to pay a double amount to the owner. That is the simple interpretation. In the Hasidic discourse that the Tzemach Tzedek gave, the Tzemach Tzedek said the following, the Torah here talks about giving something to someone to watch for safekeeping. So the Tzemach Tzedek explains that this is also a parable, it's a mashal, talking about the neshama, the soul that God gives us to watch, puts in our body, asks us to watch it. And we have here the issue that something has happened to the neshama. The neshama has been abused. The neshama has been hurt. The neshama has been under attack. And why does this come about? So verse number 8 says, according to Hasidus, what it means, again, that level of shat, a kol garpesha, there's been some sort of an abuse. And the abuse comes about because of the animal soul, which manifests itself in four different ways. One is shor, because what does the verse say for an ox? Again, on a basic interpretation, the verse is talking about these items were given and they were stolen, taken. So Siddhas explains, how shor, shor nagahu. When we talk about an ox, we relate an ox to the goring nature of a person. You have people who are just very aggressive with their animal soul. They can be offensive. They can be hurtful. They don't mind trampling on other people. That's one form of the animal soul. Aggressiveness, which can lend itself also even to violence. Al-Khamar, over a donkey. What does a donkey represent? The Gemara tells us, a donkey has frigidity. Even in the middle of the summer months, a donkey is always cold. Sometimes the animal soul throws upon us this element of frigidity. I want to skip the seh first, which is the sheep. Al-salma. Salma is a beged. The idea of beged means begida. Sometimes our animal soul expresses itself in just total rebellion against God. And then there's the al-seh, which is the third one. So here the Tzemach Tzedek tells us the problem with the sheep He brings the pasuk, Sat Pazura Yisrael, when Jews are spread out and wander like sheep. That's what this is a reference to. And here in the Sikha that there's the Sikha of the Rebbe, in the first book of Sikhas, where he says, what is the, and he explains something, well, what is the problem, what is this, the other things we can relate to. The idea of the aggressiveness of the axe within us, the frigidity of the chamar, of the donkey within us, the rebelliousness that we have, which is the idea of the Salma. What is the idea of the sepazura, this, the scattered sheep, the wandering sheep? So Samaset explains that in a certain sense, and it brings truth from another Gemara, that in a certain sense, the quality, the nature of the wandering sheep, the roaming sheep, in a certain sense, might be worse than the others. And he says, as a Jew, this past Shabbos, we had the Torah reading of Yisrael, the giving of Torah. And not just the giving of Torah, but the Jews got the pedigree where God says, you are my chosen nation. And on the one hand, Jew is expected to be a humble person. On the other hand, you're supposed to have a certain sense of royalty. We are royalty. And therefore, as royalty, we are leaders, not just followers. Not like sheep that follow and they sometimes get lost and they're scattered. The first halach in Shulchan Aruch and Chaim is al yevosh mei amaligim, that when people mock you and cynical of you, skeptical of what you're doing, instead of being concerned with what they say, to show leadership qualities, to lead and not be concerned. You know, I talked about this for Shabbos. This, as you know, yesterday was the Super Bowl. And as you know, people, everyone's excited about the Super Bowl. So when I talked about Shabbos and Shul, I said, you know, even if the Super Bowl has entertainment, which is totally kosher, which I'm not convinced about, I'm not a Super Bowl fan, I don't watch the Super Bowl, I said, but as Jews, we have a certain element of royalty to us, and that which is entertainment for the entire world, 5 billion people, should not be entertainment for us. So I told people that even if, listen, you can't expect people not to watch a Super Bowl, something which is etched in their minds, holy by many people, but if you give up, I said, you watch the first quarter and the fourth quarter, give up the second, third quarter. So I said, even though I'm not in charge of Gan Eden, but I assume there must be a special Gan Eden for those people who are Super Bowl fans who give up the second and third quarter and learn some Torah. So the Rebbe writes, Tzachsedek writes, that this idea of Ser Pazura, we're talking about this sort of a problem of the animal soul, of Ser Pazura, when a person doesn't have that temerity, doesn't have that sense of leadership, that sense of confidence, that we have Torah, we have mitzvahs, we have our mission life. This is bringing light into the world through Torah mitzvahs, not being concerned about what people are going to say about your Torah mitzvahs. And when a person doesn't have that confidence, that's what this episode of Yisrael is about. So the Talmud continues in this Maamar Chassidus. When a person has these issues, it says, Ad Elohim, you should go to Elohim. And Elohim is a reference also to the leader, where Elohim means the leader also. And your job is to go to the tzaddik of the generation, and he will tell you, Yishalom Shtayim V'Reyehu, you there have a double amount to be paid, meaning when a person has brought down the Zohar, when a person sins, and a person did study of Torah, a person needs to study, let's say, one daf, one folio, that he now study twice as much. But you need the tzaddik to give the proper direction how to do this. That's the Tzemach Tzedek's approach in understanding this. Let me just end up with one more idea. And Torah talks about, it says, if you see the axe, the chamar sanacha, you see the donkey of your enemy struggling, and v'chadalta me'az avdo also. And because this is the axe of the enemy, you really refrain. You don't want to help the enemy. You don't want to help your enemy's axe. That's verse number 5. It's in chapter 23, verse number 5. On page 97 in our Chumash. So therefore, you refrain from helping him. No. Azev tazrima, you shall surely help him along with him. So, in fact, there's no halachic issue whether there's a Torah concept of tzar bala chaim, which means, do we have to be concerned about the pain of animals or not? Can we cause animal pain? Rabbinically, you certainly can't. According to Torah, it's not so poshut, it's not so clear whether there's a Torah obligation to come to the aid of an animal that is suffering. Not that clear. The majority in the Gemara seems to be tending to that position, but it's not that clear. On the other hand, what is clear, the Gemara tells us, that even though it says you shall help your enemy's ox, even though it's the ox of your enemy, but only the verse says, Azov Tazanimo, page 298, you shall surely help along with him. So if your enemy, who owns the ox, sees the animal struggling and tells you, you know, you seem to be a religious Jew, my animal is struggling, help my animal. So you can say, what about you? I'll help you help the animal. But by myself, there's no mitzvah to make yourself into someone who steps over you, people stepping over you. A person has to have their own dignity also. And you can't allow people to take advantage of you. So even though the animal is suffering, you don't have an obligation of helping the animal if the owner of the animal is standing there and doing nothing about it. But let's get into Chassidus Shepshat, what it means over here, in verse number 5. So Chassidus tells us, it's a Yamim also, it says, when you will see Chamar Senacha, so it's on the level of Jush, when you see your Chumis, the word Chamar also means your corporeality, your physical nature. And you recognize your physical nature in a certain sense as your enemy, because what gets you in trouble is your physical desires. And you see that the body is struggling just to be healthy. And you say, you know, maybe the best way for me to control my desires is by not helping my health situation. I won't help my body be healthy. Maybe that's the best way to control my desires. I'll be unhealthy. So I won't have desires, I won't have passions, I won't have impulses, because I won't be healthy. So the verse is no. Azov Tazavimo, our job in life is not to break our body, not to crush our body. Our job is to be healthy, and to have impulses, but to control the impulses. To have desires and control the desires. And that's what the Rebbe brings down in the Yom Yom. The Chassidish understanding. So therefore, in verse number 5, on page 297, we have the pshat level, the obligation of helping an animal, according to many poskim. Again, this becomes proof positive that we have to be concerned about pain to animals. But even then, you also got to be concerned first about your dignity. That goes first. We'll continue, Mr. Shem, and we'll dive in the matter of now. Join us in the matter.